Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. A jam-packed hour for you to start off our first Open Air of 2014. I'll be talking with director John Fisher, who's artistic director of Theater Rhinoceros, which is presenting the new Stephen Sondheim musical, Roadshow. By telephone, violist Anthony Martin joins me to share details about the new Esterházy Quartet's performances this weekend. And DJ-composer Mason Bates shares his experiences with the San Francisco Symphony. Plus, it being the first Thursday of the month, critic Joshua Cosman comes in to share his classical picks for the month ahead. Stay tuned. Beginning next Wednesday, the San Francisco Symphony and Michael Tilson Thomas present a two-week festival celebrating the music of Beethoven and someone who may one day be considered a fourth B to add to the roster of Beethoven, Bach, and Brahms, DJ-composer Mason Bates, who continues his association with the San Francisco Symphony and with orchestras internationally by transforming how we think of the symphonic experience, especially by incorporating electronic sounds into the mix, as it were. Bates counts among his teachers some of the most prominent composers of our time, including David Del Tredici, Samuel Adler, John Crigliano, and, while he was at UC Berkeley, Edmund Campion. For this return visit, his San Francisco Symphony commissioned work The B-Sides will be programmed next week with Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and a couple of Beethoven romances, and the first San Francisco Symphony performance of Bates's Liquid Interface will be heard in the second week of concerts, with excerpts from King Stephen, Opus 117, and his Mass in C Major, with soloists and the amazing vocal forces of the San Francisco Symphony Chorus. Such a pleasure to welcome you to Open Air, Mason Bates, and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Sounds like you've got quite a start to 2014 and a 38th birthday coming up this month as well.
Well, 37.
37. All right. Don't push
it. But who's
right?
Counting? I've never had eight concerts follow so quickly on the new year. Glad I have at least a couple of days to get all the alcohol out of my system.
And does that come from late night DJing still, or are you still on the DJ circuit for doing this? Probably not this month.
Certainly not on New Year's. This has been actually a really nice, pretty quiet time with the family. It's kind of nice a couple times a year when everything seems to stop and you can go into a kind of forced exile with the family.
Well, doubly nice for you being from the Bay Area and having all this stuff happen here in with the San Francisco Symphony.
Well, it's phenomenal. I mean, the symphony has been such a huge part of my education the past 13, 14 years that I've been here. And it's been especially meaningful to start working with the symphony, in such a close way and have a piece like the B-Sides come back to the symphony after being premiered a few years ago.
Well, let's back up a little bit. How did this special relationship with the San Francisco Symphony start?
You know, how Michael finds things is beyond me. He is sort of like the great National Security Administration of music. I mean, he just scans the universe and figures out what he wants to zoom in on. In this case, it was around 2008, and I sort of knew Michael in a very tangential way, and I'd seen him at the symphony a few times. He kind of surprised me and just said, "I've been following what you're doing, and I would be really interested to talk to you about a suite, an orchestral suite." Mm-hmm. And it was really surprising to have somebody of his stature come to the table having listened to so much of my music and so educated about it already.
Well, it's interesting because Riccardo Muti and Leonard Slatkin are also champions of your music. Similar influence to Michael Tilson Thomas. Maybe it's something about guys in their 70s that want to boogie down with the DJ or something. I don't know. Or maybe it was another teacher of yours, Deacon Newlin, also from Richmond, Virginia, and one of the last surviving pupils of Schoenberg, who late in life, also in his 70s, became a punk rock performer. Is that, I don't know what this is about guys in their 70s.
Well, you know, the thing is, there's a special thing about symphonic music and the few people who write for the orchestra generally are people that also have an understanding of the music of our time, even though one might assume that, hey, if you're writing for an orchestra, you're only listening to classical music. But in order to create music that really travels from the pen in your studio to a symphonic space, it's inevitably going to pass through a lot of your musical influences from today, going back to Beethoven, and people like Michael, who intrinsically understand that huge range of music making, have always been attracted to my music. I do write for the orchestra, it is my medium, but I also come from an electronica background as well, and the thing that I think is very astonishing about Michael is that, yes, he's a master of Beethoven and Berlioz and, of course, Mahler, but you know, he was conducting John McLaughlin in front of the San Francisco Symphony in the 1970s. So he has this omnivorous appetite. And I guess he finds something in my music that he has kept coming back for.
Well, as a classically trained musician yourself, you studied piano, sang in choruses growing up. You're no stranger to the whole concert hall experience. Now, when did you first think about transforming that experience by adding electronica?
Well, I was in New York, that's where I went to school, and worked with John Corigliano, wonderful composer of just phenomenally imaginative scores. And I got interested in electronic music. Specifically at that time, it was trip-hop in the late 90s, drum and bass. As I've become associated with the Chicago Symphony and spent some time in the upper Midwest, I've gotten very interested in techno. I think the thing that fascinated me about that music, and to this day I find so compelling, is that it's music that is without lyrics or without a vocalist or without a melody sometimes. It's very much about texture and, you know, intricate rhythms and sonorities. And in fact, those are the things that...
An overlaying of things.
Yeah, right. I mean, this kind of mixing of many different things. And that's to a composer of symphonic music, that's not unfamiliar territory. It's just it's a new way of doing it. So we're dealing with a kind of synthesizer in the orchestra. You know, it is a synth, maybe the world's oldest synth. And I love hearing what electronic artists can do with their synths, you know, to kind of blend all manner of exotic sounds together.
Is that the kind of soundscaping you were doing in your early DJ experience now, or was it just kind of a gig to help you pay tuition bills, or is there more of a deeper ambition in creating something unique in a DJ experience?
Well, when I first was DJing, I was definitely doing it with kind of one mindset, and that was, you know, I liked spinning records, I liked, you know, creating a mix. I did not really imagine these two musics, classical music and electronica, interacting. But the more I DJed and you know, to be totally honest, the more I moved away from spinning purely kind of abstract IDM electronica, so-called intelligent dance music, and really trying to mix things like techno that take a lot more mixing skill, I found that there was a lot to be offered to a classical composer. I mean, my music often, before this, used to be divided pretty discreetly into movements. A piece like Liquid Interface has all the movements kind of dissolved, the movement breaks. So the first movement, which is Conjuring Glaciers, melts and kind of becomes the second movement, which is about water on the small scale. That kind of mixing of textures is something that definitely has come from spinning two records in a DJ booth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about this special 2 weeks coming up a bit. Now, who thought up of the pairing of Beethoven and Bates? And did you have any input in the Beethoven selections that were chosen?
I don't know, and no.
All right, next question.
No, I mean, it's certainly, it's the coolest sounding festival I'll ever be associated with, and, you know, I'm sure that this was Michael's brainchild. I have to say that something that's particularly interesting about Beethoven is that so many different composers have claimed him as a kind of, you know, predecessor, and particularly if you look at the 19th century, there were these two camps. There was, you know, the kind of academic camp, the formalists of Brahms, and then there was the great programmatic composers like Wagner and Liszt and Berlioz who were telling stories with symphonies. And they both pointed to Beethoven as a predecessor, and the programmatic composers would look at the Ninth Symphony. You know, it brought in chorus, it brought in text, it brought in this, like, content to an abstract art form. Well, to me, Beethoven very much is somebody that I look to when thinking about how to turn a symphony into a bigger experience. And so a piece like Liquid Interface, which is a water symphony, very much, I think, is, you know, that impulse to kind of tell a story. I think a lot of that goes back to the Ode to Joy.
Mm, that's true. Nice. Now, let's talk a little bit about the B-sides. It's a work that was first heard here in 2009 as a San Francisco Symphony Commission. There's probably a whole generation or two by now that has no concept of what a B-side is. So let's share it from a DJ's perspective.
Yeah, well, the B-side is usually where the less pop-friendly tracks would get banished to back in the days of records. So, and of course, you would want to front-load all of your hit-friendly songs on the A-side, and then, you know, the B-sides would be some of the more imaginative, kind of quirky, trippy tracks. I always think of the great psychedelic rock bands as the ones who really turned the concept of a B-side into a kind of experimental art form. You think of Pink Floyd, you know, some of those albums like Metal, where you have these long, expansive, improvisatory 25-minute tracks. So this piece, the B-sides, takes the concept of a kind of trippy, imaginative excursion to a surreal space as a starting point. And so it's like you're finding five bands of a forgotten record, each kind of touching down on a different landscape.
Well, we do have a brief excerpt from the B-sides. Maybe you could set this this track up for us.
Yeah, this is Broom of the System. The idea of this in this, you know, very short piece is to conjure up the chimney sweep that dusts our circuit boards of the computers. You know, you think of chimney sweeps of the old days, always sort of when you see them in movies, have this kind of rhythm to them. Well, I thought, you know, what about the...
Nowadays it's just a can of
air. Yeah, right. What about that kind of mischievous chimney sweep on the sort of landscape of our circuit boards? And so you'll hear a kind of mischievous beat played by kind of sandpaper blocks and ticking of electronics. And at one point, there's an actual room.
All right, music of Mason Bates here on KLW. Then more, we'll chat with him after that.
Thank you.
An excerpt from the B-Sides and Broom of the System, music by Mason Bates, whose B-Sides will be performed with the San Francisco Symphony next week as part of a Bates and Beethoven Festival, the brainchild of music director Michael Tilson Thomas. Some great sounds there, boy.
Thank you. I think there's actually Beethoven and Bates. I'm definitely second on the bill.
I was going alphabetical. Now, you mentioned broom, typewriter, oil drum in your program notes. Do you like extraneous percussion or just the interesting textures that you don't normally hear in an orchestral environment?
Oh, man, the percussion section is definitely the place where a lot of the confines in the orchestra can be broken down. You know, you can really ask percussionists to do anything, and they will almost always do it in the most cheerful way. This piece, like I mentioned, one you just heard, conjures a kind of chimney sweep in our circuit boards. And then I thought, you know, well, it'd be nice to have an actual broom. Not a problem at all to have that. There's a typewriter in the movement called Temescal Noir. It's kind of like a San Francisco noir set in the East Bay, and, you know, in all those great noir movies, there's always a typewriter tapping. And I found that actually that's a great instrument for very, very light, high clicks. And so I've oftentimes called for unusual percussion instruments, and it probably comes from the same impulse that has me including electronic sounds.
You're currently composer in residence with another august internationally recognized ensemble, the Chicago Symphony, and Riccardo Muti. What's that experience been like, and how are you comparing and contrasting compared to San Francisco?
Well, Chicago has, you know, a phenomenal orchestra. It's an orchestra that has various different kinds of lines of history. There's, of course, we know of the Chicago Symphony as kind of like one of the great Rolls Royces of orchestras that, you know, people want to hear, you know, Beethoven or Mahler with the Chicago Symphony. It has kind of an old school image, but of course it's played a tremendous amount of new music over the years. Its composer in residence program, is really the oldest one in the country, and started with John Corigliano. And so the musicians there have a huge breadth of knowledge, and it's been fascinating watching Riccardo Muti and the Chicago Symphony become a kind of dream team. You know, he's certainly a man who at this point is knows exactly what he wants. And the symphony, of course, like all orchestras, they have their way of doing things, and they have their way of giving back what the conductor asks for. And it's been so interesting seeing that negotiation. You know, granted, I'm living in the Bay Area, and I've been, as I mentioned before, so lucky to be part of the San Francisco Symphony's journey these past 13 or 14 years that I've been here. And you know, I do find that there is something about the West Coast approach that is particularly joyfully adventurous. You know, I think of the Mavericks Festival that had this mammoth John Cage piece on it that was mainly theater. That's something that you probably wouldn't see at the Chicago Symphony. That's certainly the brainchild of Michael.
Well, I wish you every success in these performances of Beethoven and Bates over these next 2 weeks with Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. The second week is going to be quite fascinating as well. Excerpts from King Stephen as well as the Mass in C major with some vocal forces also involved. We do have one other excerpt that I'd like you to share with us. So perhaps you could set up this last second.
Yeah, this is called Warehouse Medicine. It's an homage to the great warehouse parties of Detroit in the early 80s where techno was born. You know, a lot of us might have an image of those empty warehouses as kind of the post-apocalypse of America, but really those vast empty spaces kind of created a kind of music there, and that music was techno. So here's the finale of the B-Sides.
from Warehouse Medicine, from the B-sides, music of Mason Bates and Warehouse Medicine, music that you can hear with the San Francisco Symphony. Next week, information about the concerts of the Beethoven and Mason Bates Festival at sfsymphony.org. Well, thanks for taking some time for coming in today on this second day of the new year, 2014. And happy birthday, by the way, 37 coming up on the 23rd, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And these concerts are a great excuse for you to celebrate early, I think, with family and friends here in the Bay Area. I wish you only the best for the coming year. And really look forward to what comes out of your quill and ink pot in the months and years ahead.
Well, thanks so much. It's been great to be here.
Still to come, critic Joshua Cosman talks about the month ahead in music. Next, a talk with members of the new Esterházy Quartet and director John Fisher on the new Stephen Sondheim musical. Stay with us. Orchestra introduction to Haydn's Symphony No. 85, a work you can hear in a quartet arrangement this weekend featuring one of my next guests. The members of the new Esterházy String Quartet, violinists Lisa Weiss and Katie Keim, cellist William Skeen, and violist Anthony Martin, who I'll be talking with shortly, specialize in period performance and can often be seen and heard occupying the first chairs of groups, including the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra and American Bach soloists. As a quartet, they use Franz Joseph Haydn's 68 quartets as their core repertoire and have been recognized as one of the world's top period instrument string quartets, having most recently expanded their repertoire to include quartet arrangements of Haydn and Mozart symphonies. Their latest concert program, entitled Paris Symphonies, will be performed this weekend in Berkeley, Palo Alto, and San Francisco. Violinist-violist Anthony Martin grew up in Santa Rosa and attended Stanford University as well as the Peabody Conservatory and Boston University, and he joins me now by phone. Anthony, welcome back to the airwaves, if not the physical studios of KLW.
Thank you.
Well, let's start backing up a little bit with the title of the quartet you're a member of and the new Esterházy Quartet. Now, I've had some guests on and have glossed over the importance of the Esterházy Quartet on the assumption that, well, everyone has had Music Ed 101 and probably recently. So I think maybe a brief historical recap is in order, if you will, for those who might have slept through the class, or maybe some fresh knowledge for those unfamiliar with Esterházy and Esterháza. Would you be so kind?
Well, there are two aspects to our name. One is, as you say, the Esterházy family and court, Hungarian aristocrats dating back to the Middle Ages, who in 18th century Viennese society were among the top economic interests on the Hungarian side of the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg monarchy, and they maintained a lavish estate, which started off like Versailles as a hunting lodge, and became, and like Versailles, just grew and grew and grew. And Haydn was the house musician, the head musician, and he worked for the Esterházy family for 30 years. And he was in the boonies. Nowadays, you can drive from Esterházy to Vienna on an autobahn. Back in the day, however, it was a two-day coach ride to get to the capital.
But still, nonetheless, what you and I as musicians would call a pretty good steady gig.
Oh, it was a wonderful gig. And Haydn, in fact, credited the fact that his prince valued him as one of the pluses. And the other plus was its relative isolation. He said that living out in the boonies, there was not the usual intrigues and rivalries, and thus he was able to develop according to his own taste and his own speed. And he also had an orchestra there with which he could quickly get feedback on his ideas and experimentations, and figure out what worked and what didn't.
Now, your program will be called Paris Symphonies. What do Haydn, Mozart, and Cherubini have to do with Paris? Haydn was never even there, after all.
That's very true, but Paris certainly was artistically and financially a target of any ambitious composer. And Haydn, although he was never physically there, the Parisians were certainly aware of his quartets and his symphonies, and in fact, a set of six were commissioned by an orchestra in Paris. It was an orchestra of a Freemason lodge, the Olympic Lodge, had their own orchestra, and they commissioned a set of six symphonies. And what's quite wonderful is that the year after they were first played in Paris in 1788, three of those symphonies appeared as quartet arrangements from the publisher Artaria in Vienna, arranged for a string quartet. Now, the question is, was this some kind of scurrilous arrangement done without Haydn's permission or knowledge, or, in fact, did Haydn have a hand in it? And indications are that he did, because it's the same publisher just a year after the quartet arrangement of the Seven Last Words appeared. And that, we know from surviving letters, Haydn himself made the arrangement.
Well, it seems infinitely practical, because he'd have his music being able to be played by a much larger group of people, meaning even though it's a smaller ensemble, a quartet, than by a full symphony.
Yes.
So he's getting his music out there. Then.
Yeah, you don't have the chance to own a recording, but you do have a chance to play the music and get familiar with it in your own living room.
Well, I'm glad you explained that, because I thought it was, the Esterházy was getting a little bit greedy. You already have the 68 quartets of Haydn, and now you're going after the 100-plus symphonies of Haydn. Do we know how many of these have actually been arranged? You mentioned a couple of them. Are you actually actively involved in arranging some of the others?
Well, of Haydn, we have contemporary, that is to say, during Haydn's lifetimes, we have printed editions of six of his 104 symphonies. So we've got a ways to go. But on the other hand, we've only played one, the London Symphony, we performed last year. This year we play, it's not called the Paris Symphony, but it's a symphony whose nickname is La Reine, or the Queen of France. So that will have to do. It was said to have been Marie Antoinette's favorite of the six symphonies. She attended the concerts at which these symphonies were given their premieres.
And I believe rumored that she kept a score of the quartet, or if not the symphony, in her cell. I don't know if that's apocryphal or not.
The score of the symphony was found by a visitor among the music on an out of tune harpsichord. We think of cell in terms of visions of damp stone walls, but of course at that time aristocrats, the favored people, even the Marquis de Sade, stayed in more like house arrest apartments, not their own houses, but it wasn't quite a cell. On the other hand, under guard and not able to leave without permission, and she ended up leaving only to lose her head.
So, indeed. So we have the Mozart, the connection between Marie Antoinette and Haydn, but there's also a Mozart connection, also reflected on your Paris Symphony program. Could you share with us the connection that Marie Antoinette had with young Wolfgang?
Well, I'm not sure I can make a plausible connection directly with the Queen of France and Mozart. His Paris Symphony, so-called Paris Symphony, now was actually written for a different orchestra, the Concert Spirituel, and it's not known whether she went to that, whether she went to the Concert Spirituel's performances or not. But in any case, he was commissioned by the head of that orchestra to write a symphony for their concerts, and he actually went to the single rehearsal that the premiere of this Mozart symphony received, and was horrified, and wrote home to his dad, whom he confided at least musical things in, that he was really afraid of what was going to happen. But as it turned out, in fact, he was threatening.
And I bet you Leopold wrote back, "Don't lose your head, Leopold. Don't lose your head, Wolfgang. You'll be fine."
Well, that all came later. It was safely a world of aristocratic privilege and patronage when Wolfgang was there. He was only 22. It was He was middle-aged, I guess.
Indeed. Well, I'm talking with Anthony Martin, violist with the new Esterházy Quartet. Anthony, I'm happy to share this anecdote that I learned in my research on the Mozart flute quartets. Apparently, Wolfgang and his, I believe at that time in the early visit to Paris, was with his father, who I think his first visit was about at the age of six. And apparently after playing piano in front of who would be the future queen, she was all of maybe 16 or 9. I forget. They were both children. Wolfgang apparently jumped up into her lap and asked her to marry him.
So, imagine how history would have turned out if that happened.
Indeed. Or if Haydn had an extra opening for a concertmaster in Esterházy.
Yeah. No, well, I don't think Mozart would have moved out into the boonies. He did all he could to get out of Salzburg.
That's true.
Which was slightly even more sophisticated than Esterházy. So I think Mozart really was looking for a good job in Vienna and never quite got the connection he needed or wanted.
So back to these quartet arrangements, what do you lose going from an orchestral arrangement to a string quartet? And maybe you can share what you gain as well.
Well, of course, you lose the colors, first of all, of massed strings as opposed to single strings on one and apart, and you lose the colors of the wind instruments, which are very important to any symphonist. Speaking as a string player, I will state that an orchestra is a string body with wind instruments. If you were talking to an oboist, he would give you a different opinion. But so those colors are not present. But what you gain, of course, is a kind of a transparency in which each part is clearly etched. It may be, say, the difference between a watercolor and a pen and ink drawing. The detail in pen and ink is simply not achievable with watercolors, and it's the same with a quartet arrangement. Now, of course, there's also the danger of losing particular voices you have in orchestras, orchestral music, for instance, long-sustained notes by the horns. But if there are other things going on, you can't just have the viola play the horn part. The viola might be needed to play the viola part. So some of those colors are lost, but clarity is gained.
So the program this weekend will include Haydn's Symphony No. 85 in a quartet arrangement, La Reine. Also, Mozart's Symphony No. 31, the Paris Symphony, dubbed in a quartet version. And then Cherubini's Quartet No. 2, which is actually based on a symphony in D. Could you share with us a little bit of information about the Cherubini?
Yes, I mean, it's a little embarrassing because the Cherubini Symphony was written for London rather than for Paris. However, it wasn't so well received. In fact, the symphony in the 19th century, Cherubini's only symphony, received very few performances. But Cherubini evidently thought well enough of it that when it came time for him to assemble a group of three string quartets for publication over a dozen years after he wrote the symphony, he did an arrangement of the symphony. He transposed it to C from D, and he provided an entirely new slow movement changed the symphonic slow movement to something new and written specifically for quartet, and I might add something of a very personal nature, at least so it seems to us.
Interesting.
I think calling it a Paris symphony is maybe a bit of a stretch, but he did the rearrangement and published the quartet in the quartet version in Paris, and we have a patron and friend, Don McDonald in Palo Alto, who has followed us from the very beginning. Don is now 95, and he comes faithfully to all of our concerts. He's told us of his listening to the great quartets, Budapest Quartet, the Kolish Quartet, the Kulish Quartet, when he was a teenager back in the day, and he has been very flattering and complimentary to our performances. Don had requested that we play some Cherubini.
Nice.
And this was the one that kind of fit into a program that we wanted to play anyway.
And as the new Esterházy Quartet, have either you or the quartet spent any time in Hungary at Esterházy or Zá?
Well, I have been to Eisenstadt, which was the administrative capital for the Esterházy family, as opposed to the Grand Hunting Lodge, say the Paris to Versailles Eisenstadt to Esterhazy would be the analogous place. I think Lisa Weiss has been to Esterhazy, and I wish someday that I would get there and see the rooms in which some of this music was first heard.
Well, that's a fine New Year's resolution for you, Anthony.
Yeah.
Anthony Martin, violist with the new Esterhazy Quartet, with the rest of his quartet, Katie Keim on violin, along with Lisa Weiss and William Skeen on cello. They'll be performing a program entitled Paris Symphonies, music of Haydn, Mozart, and Cherubini this weekend. Tomorrow in Berkeley, Saturday in San Francisco here at St. Mark's Lutheran, and Sunday in Palo Alto. Information at newesterhazy.org. That's new, Esterhazy.org. Anthony, I wish you some splendid performances, and we'll get you back in the studio sometime soon, I hope.
Thanks very much.
Still to come, Joshua Cosman, and some Sondheim ahead with director John Fisher.
As Papa would say, you're hot, then you're not. You better learn to bounce. If something goes wrong, that's all right. Bounce along. Just travel light. You go off the track. Don't look back. That's the thing that counts. You hit a few bumps. You make a few gaps. You learn how to bounce. You take a few lumps. You have a few laughs. And all the while you bounce. Don't dwell on the times that you fail. Remember the times when you sail. Find a new road, forge a new trail. Bounce.
That's a tune called Bounce from the musical of the same name by Stephen Sondheim, a musical that has its current incarnation as Roadshow, and it's having its Bay Area premiere under the auspices of Theater Rhinoceros at the Eureka Theater. Opening in preview tonight and opening officially on Saturday through the 19th of January. I'm talking with John Fisher, the executive director of Theater Rhinoceros and director of Roadshow. This new Stephen Sondheim show, with new in air quotes, as the show has had previous incarnations as Wise Guys and Bounce, as we just heard that cut, here to talk about it. And to share the bounces along the road that led to its current version is John Fisher. John's plays have been produced in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, New Haven, and on HBO as part of the annual U.S. Comedy Arts Festival. Among his accolades, he's the recipient of an NEA grant, the GLAAD Media Award for Best Theater, the L.A. Weekly Award for Best Musical and Best Script, as well as 10 Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Awards. His play, The Joy of Gay Sex, was produced off-Broadway, and Medea, the musical, which was produced as part of the HBO Comedy Arts Festival, ran for 18 months in its original San Francisco production. With a Ph.D. from UC Berkeley, where he also taught there, and at UC Santa Cruz, it's indeed an honor to welcome here to Open Air. Hi, John.
It's great to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, let's share some bumps along the road to Roadshow. I know that this isn't the first version of the show, but I think it's now in its final version as Roadshow officially?
Yes. Stephen Sondheim has written a lot about this show in his books. It started out as Wise Guys in a workshop production with Nathan Lane and Victor Garber. And then it was morphed into Bounce, which played in Chicago at the Goodman Theater, and is now finally what Stephen Sondheim considers to be the final version, Roadshow. And it's the story of the Meisner brothers, a local story, actually. They were from Benicia, California, and San Francisco. So
Who were the Meisner brothers?
The Meisner brothers were they were from a first family of Benicia. And their father had made the mistake of investing in Benician real estate because he knew it was going to be the state capital. And it was briefly, but then it shifted.
Not so much.
Yeah. So the family fell in hard times and the sons went on the road. And one brother was a famous architect and the other was a scammer. So it's the story of two brothers, and it's kind of like The Sting. It's they run some scams, some stings. They make a lot of money and then they lose it. And so it's kind of a classic Depression-era story.
Well, it's interesting that because right now also at the Benicia Historical Museum in Benicia, there's an exhibit called Those Amazing Meisners, Benicia's Celebrated Clan. So you know, one can see exhibit about these true-to-life characters as well as catch the show at the Eureka. Now, have you been in touch with Sondheim about this show, or is he busy doing other things?
He's busy doing other things. He's actually now turning one of his first great musicals, Company, into an all-male production.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah. So a story about marriage with eight married couples on stage is, I think, providentially becoming a story about gay marriage.
Yes.
And so that he's buried in that, and he's like a monk when he's working. He will send you an email, but he can't do the phone call. So he's been very sweet and very supportive. He's put us in touch with his co-writer on this show, John Weidman, who has talked a lot with us about it. But Stephen's in the trenches of...
Company.
Yeah, of Company.
It's interesting. I think a lot of people have posited that the character, main character in Company, as an aside, Bobby, was a gay man, or that Sondheim maybe originally intended him to be a gay man.
He certainly has a lot of trouble finding a mate, doesn't he? I mean, he has tons of opportunities.
Only female opportunities.
Only
in the
female opportunities. He's the only... Yeah. So maybe that's where he's headed off at the end. to be gay. It'll be interesting to see what Stephen does with it.
So how is this changed from its various incarnations into Roadshow?
Well, I think the original workshop was very much like a floor show. It was very much about talking to the audience and telling the story. That was Wise Guys. And then when it became Bounce, it fell under the influence of Sondheim collaborator Hal Prince. And Hal Prince was like, he's like an old-time producer. He's like, where's the girl? You got to have a girl. So it became very much about Wilson Meisner and his girlfriend, wife. And when that production didn't quite succeed in Chicago, Sondheim took it back, worked on it with Sam Mendes, and turned it back into the story that he wanted it to be, which was about the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It was really about the relationship between the brothers. And the romance that he emphasized was the romance of Addison Meisner, who was gay and had a boyfriend, Hollis. So one of the Big Love songs, which was originally sung in the Hal Prince production by a man and a woman, is now sung by two men.
And that tune is The Best Thing That Has Ever Happened to Me.
The Best Thing That Has Ever Happened to Me. Beautiful song.
Well, let's hear that now. We're going to hear Alex Gemignani sing this from Roadshow, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay.
You are the best thing that ever has happened to me. You are. Okay then, one of the best things that's happened to me. You are. They say we all find love. I never bought it. I never thought it would happen to me. See, you are the goddamnedest thing that has happened to me ever. When did I have this much happiness happen to me? Never. I can't believe my luck, and all I can do is be the best thing that's happened to me.
The Best Thing That Has Ever Happened to Me, from the show Roadshow, in preview tonight, opening Saturday at Theater Rhinoceros, Eureka Theater, Jackson Street at Front and Battery. Now through the 19th of January, with me talking about that is John Fisher, the director and executive director of Theater Rhinoceros. Great tune. Originally, we were talking about some of the changes that these various show incarnations had. That was a duet between a man and a woman. Now a duet between two men.
That's right. Seems to have followed the history of marriage pretty accurately.
The tune we started with, too, Bounce, is the melody is the same, but the words have changed to somewhat.
Yeah, Bounce, the song is the opening number of the show, and originally it was Bounce, but now that word has been replaced by the word waste, and it's the brothers expressing their frustration with the challenges they've felt in their life. They feel like their lives are waste.
So in the original incarnation as Bounce, it was about bouncing back, and it's reflecting back.
Exactly. Very well put. It was originally about survival, and now it's about sort of feeling like you screwed up.
So what are we going to see in this roadshow interpretation visually at Eureka Theater?
I think the thing that it's about really for me is roadshow. It's about going on the road and going out and having adventures and making money and meeting people and taking on the world. So our show moves. Everything's on wheels. Even our accompanist, Dave Dabrowski, his piano is on wheels.
That's great.
And he will be playing as he moves. So the scenery moves, the actors move. It's really a show about movement. It really is a road show. I've taken it very literally. And I think there's a lot in the music and the characters. It's a kind of a carnival that these guys led. That was their lives. It was a carnival. Mm-hmm. And so we're not clowns, but we're going on the road. We're a three-ring circus at the Eureka.
And how did the Misners end, and was it a pleasant experience for them, and is it reflected so in Roadshow?
Well, I think that they ended not well. I mean, the Depression hit them both pretty hard, the crash in 1929, and I think that that's also why the show's so topical, because of our recent struggles with the economy. But anyway, their lives did not end well. Addison was a famous architect. He lost all of his commissions.
He designed Boca Raton.
He created Boca Raton, and...
Boca Raton, Florida. For people that may not be familiar, the architectural style is all Misner.
That's right. And he was a brilliant architect. He believed in stealing ideas from the old world and refashioning them in the United States. And he hated anything new, hated it. He was the guy who originally buried pianos in the backyard to give them antique look and shot holes into them so that it looked like worms had gotten at them. He hated new
very
stuff.
Very trendy. I mean, that's...
It's very trendy. Yeah, yeah. They once did a Spanish tile roof on one of his buildings, and he went up there with a sledgehammer and smashed all the tiles. He said he wanted buildings to look like they'd been through earthquakes, like they had history. And he was a brilliant architect, but he lost all of his commissions. And his brother, Wilson, went to Hollywood and ended up creating the Brown Derby. And but he unfortunately sort of sank into a banquette there and died at his table.
Wow.
And sort of a tragic Hollywood ending. So,
and Addison died just a couple of months before him, too.
Very close together. It was very sad. But fortunately, Stephen Sondheim ends it either in heaven or hell, we can't tell which, where they're basically amused by their lives. They take them with a grain of salt.
Well, what were some of the other adventures, or more appropriately, misadventures that these brothers were involved in?
They went everywhere. Their father was an ambassador, so they had the lust for travel. Guatemala, Indonesia, China. They were obsessed with movement. Everywhere they went, they were on the make. They went to the Yukon, but they didn't. They mined for gold, but they really found that the money was in like opening a saloon, right? They were parasites. They understood that there was money to be made, but it wasn't always in the obvious way you thought. And that was Addison was the first great architect of rich matrons, people who made their money in industry and wanted to. Build a nice house.
Sort of like the gold rush people who made more money selling equipment to the miners than ever for gold.
Whatever. I mean, they had that San Francisco gold rush mentality. And, Addison Meisner figured out that if you were like really mean to your matron clients, they loved it. If you told them what taste was, they listened to you. And he was very overbearing, but fun.
Mm-hmm. That's John Fisher. Thanks so much for being with me, John. Theater Rhinoceros presents the Bay Area premiere of the Stephen Sondheim musical Roadshow, all about the fascinating Meisner boys. Information at therhino.org. Thanks for coming by. We'll see you again soon, John. And next here on Open Air for the first Thursday of the month, Joshua Cosman sliding into place to share some of his classical music picks in these final moments of the first episode of Open Air for 2014. Happy New Year,
thanks,
Joshua.
David. Happy New Year back at you.
What's on your list?
I've got a lot of good things coming in January. That's the good news. The bad news is they're all happening the same weekend. So this is going to be the weekend of the 23rd
with
to the 26th.
With the exception of my most recent guest.
Not
please,
all of them.
Please, yes.
You're right. Well, I had Mason's music at the top of my list, and then when I found out you were having him in here in person, I quickly scrambled to fill. So yes, the Bates and Beethoven festival is coming starting next week and the week after, but then the big concentration of music this month is going to be from the 23rd through the 26th, starting with the pianist Emmanuel Axe, who has a wonderful new project that he's been gearing up the last year or so called Brahms and Beyond, in which he takes music of Brahms and pairs it with commissioned pieces by some of the really interesting new young composers that are out there. The first concert of this series is going to be on Thursday, January 23rd at Cal Performances at Zellerbach Hall. And he's going to have with him the mezzo-soprano Anna-Sophie von Otter, who's going to sing several sets of Brahms' Lieder. And then he's going to pair that with new piano pieces that have been written for the project by composers Missy Mazzoli and Nico Muli, two of the really kind of starry young up-and-comers. So that's on Thursday the 23rd at Cal Performances, information at calperformances.org. And I'll probably pitch this again next month, but for now you can mark your calendar for the 26th of February. The second concert in that series is going to have Emmanuel Ax with his longtime recital partner, cellist Yo-Yo Ma.
Fantastic.
Then, that same weekend, if you feel like taking a trek, or if you live in the North Bay, I'm going to at least drive up from the city to the Green Music Center in Sonoma for a visit from the English Concert, which is the British period instrument ensemble led by Trevor Pinnock.
For a long time now, boy.
Very long, 30 years at least. And they're going to do one performance in Sonoma there of Handel's oratorio, Theodora. This is one of his last vocal works, one of his last oratorios. It's a story about a Christian martyr and her Roman boyfriend turned Christian, who they perished together at the end. Spoiler alert. But along the way, there's some magnificent music, and they've got a wonderful cast of early music singers, including the soprano Dorothea Rushman in the title role as Theodora. There's the British mezzo-soprano Sarah Connolly and everybody's favorite countertenor David Daniels. That's going to be on January 25th, Saturday night, at Weill Concert Hall in Sonoma. The website for information is GMC, that's greenmusiccenter.sonoma.edu.
Well, speaking of fantastic interpreters of the music of Handel, we have with us a recording of the great Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing a little bit of Theodora. Let's hear that. What are we going to hear?
This is
that?
The aria Defend Her Heaven. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Harry Bickett.
Music of Handel, and then more with Joshua Cosman. Too brief excerpt of the beautiful artistry of Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing from Handel's
Theodora,
to be heard at Weill Concert Hall, gmc.sonoma.edu, on the 25th. What else you got, Josh?
Also, that same weekend, San Francisco Performances is going to present a pair of really exciting-looking vocal recitals on Friday night, the 24th. They've got Alice Coote, the great English mezzo-soprano, who has not been here in too long. The last time she was in the Bay Area was in 2010, when she sang in a wonderful production of Massenet's Werther at San Francisco Opera. She was supposed to be here this past June for Tales of Hoffman, then she canceled. And she's an artist of great imagination and skill and vitality, and always a pleasure to hear. She's got a very strange and interesting program, sort of one or two songs each by something like a dozen different French composers. There doesn't seem to be a single set in the bunch, but whatever she does is always interesting and worth hearing. She's going to have Graham Johnson as her piano accompanist. And that will be at San Francisco Performances, as I say, at sfperformances.org. That will be on Friday, January 24th, at the San Francisco Conservatory Concert Hall. And then, 2 days later, also at the San Francisco Conservatory Concert Hall, we have the return of Heidi Melton, whom some of us remember as an Adler Fellow. She was a soprano, is a soprano, who was a terrific, promising Adler Fellow, and was here and giving notice of future stardom right out of the gate, and indeed has gone on to an increasingly visible career as an opera star. She's going to be doing a recital program of music by Berlioz, Haydn, and Jake Heggie.
Information, once again, at sfperformances.org. Time for just one more pick.
Okay, one more quick pick, and that is the great Wu Man, the Chinese-born virtuoso of the pipa, the Chinese lute, and she has done an enormous number of different things with her instrument over the years, collaborated with the Kronos Quartet and the Art Ensemble of Chicago, as well as doing traditional stuff, and she's going to give a concert on Sunday the 26th at Berkeley, thanks under Cal Performances, which will be a guided history of the instrument from its classical roots to some of the contemporary music that has been written for her and for the instrument. That's at Hertz Hall.
Once again, information at calperformances.org as we hear a little bit of the pipa and say goodbye. Joshua, I promise next month to maybe not you get out of breath for the last stretch of the show.
I'm in training to be an auctioneer, David. This is always good practice.
Always good to have you. Happy New Year to
you. Thanks, you too.
That's it for Open Air this week. My thanks, as always, to producer Niels Swinkels for helping make things happen. Join me next week at the same time here on Local Public Radio, KALW.